Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workers Mic right here on 720 WGN. We're powered by the National Coalition of Labor. I am Ed Maher with the NCL, and with me today is Phil Davidson from the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Ed.
Ken's not here today.
No, Ken.
Ken is he's traveling. He is preaching the good word of public employee representation out in the great state of California.
Ooh.
I know, they're clamoring for Ken Edwards as far away as Sacramento, California. So,
always in Sactown. Oh, that's right. We talked about that last week.
Yeah, so we'll be missing Ken for sure. But later on in the show, we're going to have
a special
guest.
Do some fishing out there?
If there's anywhere to fish, I'm sure he will find
it. Yeah, he'll find it. Yeah.
Yeah, I've never actually been to Sacramento, so I don't know what's going on.
It's inland.
There.
So
I know they bear the brunt of a lot of like the wildfire smoke and stuff. I know,
yes,
a guy who lives near there, and he says he can't go out of his house in the summer.
Yeah,
which that's pretty rough.
Yeah,
but hey, we all got problems, right?
Well, that's what we got in Sacramento.
Yeah, that's what I know.
It's all the smoke that collects from wildfires.
That and the Kings.
Yes, in the capital.
Yeah, for sure. On the topic of travel. United flight attendants.
Very good segue.
You like that? He's flying there. I assume he's flown to California. United's flight attendants announced this week. This is something we've been watching pretty closely. They got a deal with United for a new contract. 5 years, they got 31% in raises. But the things that are interesting are they got boarding pay, which is they're going to get paid for the things they do, standing there at the gate, putting up with people's crap and elbowing each other. And, you know, as you line people up, get them on the plane. For forever, they only got paid when the door on the plane closed.
Right.
So if everybody got on or if the flight was delayed, these people are working for nothing.
When does the clock start? When?
So now I guess it'll start when they're boarding.
Got it. Okay.
So, I mean, you know, whatever.
Extra hour?
On a routine flight, that probably adds an hour to their pay. And then if they are delayed, like if a flight's delayed for, I think, more than 2 hours, they get special pay for that, which is good because, you know, these people, traveling to the airport's not cheap.
No.
If you went there and your flight got canceled, these people weren't getting paid,
mm-mm,
which, you know, it's insane.
Especially with the crazy weather we have because of the environment continuing to warm. You never know when your flight's going to go off and when it's going to get canceled. It seems like flight cancellations due to weather are happening more and more frequently.
It's happened to me a couple times in the last few years, and it drives me nuts. And there are people who get really frustrated with the flight attendants and the people at the boarding counter, but
they take it out on them.
I reserve my frustration for the passengers because I find that 99 times out of 100, it's the passengers.
Despicable people.
Mostly the small ones that cough and blow snot, you know, in my direction.
God.
I feel like every time I get off a plane, I'm sick for a couple days.
Yeah, you got to take some emergencies for sure before you board.
Yeah, this is my old age. I'm getting
also
weak.
Did you know that? Apparently, I read an article recently that, like, Delta is considered, like, high society flying, and, like, social influencers are, like, posting pictures of their Delta Sky Miles.
I think Delta has infiltrated your social media and
apparently,
is tricking you into thinking that.
I was like, not my experience with them, but okay.
I have flown on Delta, and I mean, you know, like, I don't know what domestic...
Non-union flight attendants.
Okay,
right.
Boo.
Yeah, boo.
But I don't know what domestic airline I would really classify as luxury.
Yeah.
I think we're just sort of like middling. We're fair to middling.
I just
stick with United because it's easy to get flights out of Chicago. But
American no longer offers miles if you book economy rate.
Really?
Yeah.
What's up with that?
I was like, well, I'm never going to fly with you again. Like, right. So I have to fly first
class?
Listen,
they've got pilots and flight attendants that are trying to earn a living, Phil.
Yeah, so that's just great, but
you know,
okay.
Well, whatever. You still try and fly with them.
Okay, I'm just trying to earn some miles here.
Mile hogger. and then, you know, one thing that that I enjoy, I'm one of my only friends that actually enjoys this sport, but it's Formula One, right?
Oh, yeah.
Spurred a little bit by the Netflix series, but I was a fan before all that. This weekend, of course, today there's a race in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, big sporting events attract a lot of travelers and people stay and people go out and enjoy the restaurants and the bars.
A little revelry.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're looking for entertainment late at night, you know, having a good old time. And with that in mind, the exotic dancers in the city of Montreal have decided
to. Of which there are many.
Apparently, there's more than I haven't thought about it, but You've been there to Montreal a few times, huh?
I have, because I used to live near the border, not for trips specifically for this, but okay. The zoning laws are interesting there. Like, there's exotic clubs like next to a Subway, next to a kid's clothing store. They're just everywhere you look in downtown Montreal. It's a little bit jarring.
Interesting.
Yes.
You do seem to know a lot about this.
This is just my experience. I didn't say I went inside. I was just saying from outsider perspective.
Very important clarification.
Yes, I was surveying the land.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You got to know your surroundings.
Yes.
The exotic dancers are going to walk out are we going to walk out this weekend because they have come to the conclusion that they want to earn salary. They want to be on salary. They, you know, you go in and the group is called, I don't have a French accent and I can't pronounce things very well in French, but the group is called Committee Autonome du Travail du Sexe. I think it means Sex Workers Committee, but the acronym in French is CATS, which I think is awesome. But they have banded together and they're saying they don't want to work just for strictly tips anymore because they have expenses when they go to work. They have to tip out the bartenders and the DJ, and sometimes they're spending more than they're making.
Okay.
And also being classified as independent contractors rather than employees. The example that was given, I'm not making this up, but the example that was given was, if you are dancing in high heels on a dance floor that has uneven planks of wood, you can fall down and hurt yourself.
Hazard pay.
And there's no paid leave. There's, you know, no medical insurance outside of, you know, what they get from the government. So these workers are saying, like, we're done doing this for tips, and we want to figure out some sort of a salary scale. And, you know, we've covered a similar story. I think it was out in California. There were dancers that had organized with Actors Equity, I want to say. And then, of course, more recently, the brothel in Nevada that organized with the CWA. And we hope to actually have representatives on the air to talk about that from that union.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just kind of an interesting
thing.
You're
always on top of the exotic dancers. I'm trying to talk about what's going on.
Terrible choice of words.
The construction trades. It's always bringing in the news on.
Listen, this is the worker's mic, okay? And I think it's important that, you know, as I always say, there is dignity in every job.
There is.
And, you know, especially in some of these jobs where I think it becomes easier for people to be exploited.
That is for certain.
When folks say, like, hey, listen, this isn't working out, we need a little bit better treatment or a little better something for ourselves, we need to listen to it. We need to hear it out. And, you know, in this case, I thought it was interesting and timely.
Did you get a sense of, like, are many of the dancers part of this union? Like,
I didn't really get a
sense.
Do they
have enough to make an impact?
It sounds like it.
Like I said, there's a lot of them.
You keep bringing up how many clubs there are in Montreal. And you seem like
I deserve that.
You're looking up with a look of nostalgia in your eyes as you do it, but it's making it kind of weird, Phil.
This is slanderous.
The old days,
just saying there's, and Montreal's known as being
it's big news up there. So yes. I think it's going to be enough to be noticed. And,
okay.
You know, things like this, I think, are often the jumping off point for, you know, a larger push to form a formal union or things like that. So I think this is the first we're hearing about this.
And you got to say, hey, just all things being equal, brilliant strategy to do it during Formula One weekend. That's where you have leverage.
Right. You know? When people are traveling into town and all of a sudden you can, you know, stand outside and picket or whatever, yes, whatever they're planning to do.
If it was bird watching weekend, I'd be like, maybe not the right weekend to do it. But
do they have bird watching weekend
probably
in Montreal?
Do. Yeah, they probably do.
You don't
do.
Know anything about that, Phil.
Just...
All right. Well, clearly we know exactly what Phil was doing in Montreal.
Just remember who brought up this story, everybody.
Listen, I read the news, Phil, okay? That's the difference between you and me, man. Anyway, we got to take a quick break, folks. But we're going to be back with more Workers' Mic right after this.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, Voya Financial, and United Healthcare.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. I'm Ed Maher, back with Phil Davidson. There was a story this week about Waymo and about all these Teamsters locals that have been really fighting a good fight in Illinois against this bill to allow Waymo, which is automated you know, automated
driverless vehicles.
Yeah, it's like an Uber, but there's no driver.
Right.
And they want to, they've started doing this in Texas and California. They're looking at it in Boston, and they wanted to do it in Illinois and basically just do like a 3-year study, put these things on the road, see what happens. And if everybody doesn't die, then they'll just take over for Uber. You know what I mean? Which, in a state where you've got 100,000 rideshare drivers, you've got to take some of these things into consideration. So Ken did a great job on Worker Wednesday talking about that. But since then, there's been some interesting news, namely that Waymo has recalled almost 4,000 of its vehicles in Texas because in San Antonio, where they had an accident recently already, a car, thankfully, that did not have a passenger, they had flooding. And it drove straight into the flooding, doesn't know how to handle water, so it just drove right into it and was washed away. And so Waymo just said, oh, okay, well, we're going to recall these vehicles and do a software update. So somebody somewhere in Texas, their job is write a software update to tell a car how to recognize water and not drive into it. You know, smarter people than us, I guess, Phil.
I guess, but yeah, I'm thumbs down all the way on Waymo.
Yeah, they've ceased operations for now San Antonio.
Not even from a safety perspective. I'm sorry, I'm never going to get on board with automating jobs that at one point, or not even at one point, even today, especially with all the struggles people are having in a city like Chicago and other large metropolitan areas where it's hard to make ends meet. It's hard to find affordable housing. I can't get behind something that's going to take jobs away from people that have been, you know, dependable for a long time. And granted, are Uber drivers getting rich off it? No.
No.
But it's a reliable source of income. And this idea of, like, who wins? Like, the shareholders at Waymo? That's they're not passing that down to everyone else. I just...
Right.
I don't really see the benefit in this other than potentially convenience, but it's not going to help grow the economy, in my opinion. You can try to spin it any way you want, but if you look, you know, the downstream effects, I just don't see how this is a good thing, and I support every effort to block it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you raise a lot of good points, Phil, and for listeners, I'd say also who, you know, are just like, don't fight technology. Technology has, you know, over the past, I don't know what, say like 10 years, 15 years that the gig economy has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. People have been pushed out of traditional jobs, and a lot of the folks that are in the gig economy, that's where they came from.
Right.
If they were laid off or downsized or whatever, they wound up doing Uber Eats or driving for Uber or Lyft or whatever. And so now technology is coming for those jobs.
Yes.
I mean, Uber drivers are the folks that are out there fighting to be classified as employees rather than independent contractors so that they can work and still get insurance, still have, you know, some chance at saving for retirement. And now technology is coming for them. So if folks are getting pushed out of traditional work downward into the gig economy, and then we push them out of the gig economy,
right,
what's supposed to happen to them? I mean, everyone's like, oh, you know, you create technology, you get rid of jobs, and that opens up opportunities for them to go back to school. You know, 5 years ago, it was learn
right.
to code.
Right.
I feel bad for any of the folks that ran out and learned how to code because exactly. then they're losing their jobs to AI for that. So at some point, you know, like if people aren't able to work, they're going to be relying on social safety nets, you know, and we shouldn't be sort of cheering for
no.
advancements that drive that.
No.
Because ultimately that just
it's
comes out of taxes.
It's going to come back and bite us in the you know what.
Yeah.
And yeah, I support technology. I know it's part of societal evolution, but I draw the line when it comes at the expense of human jobs.
And let's
these
not,
are going to robots.
And,
that's,
right.
and then if you
and the
go,
robots can't drive.
They
They're
can't
not
drive.
Good drivers.
And yet, you want to go back to the safety element of it is. We can't control what AI is going to be doing in the very near future. It's happening now.
Yeah.
Like, we're seeing how they are manipulating the testing, and they're having, you know, conversations outside of what they're being told to do with their safety checks and everything. Like, who knows what these things are going to be doing in a couple of years from now? Like,
right.
There's real no checks and balances over it. And, you know, I guess you can say they are, but there's just been more and more instances of artificial intelligence acting on its own volition and being sentient at this point. So,
all right, just let's not get too carried away here, Phil.
It's happening.
Phil's our AI, you know, fear-mongering correspondent on occasion.
Doom scroller, but that's my point. It's just...
I'm with you.
I don't really see how this is going to just be a major benefit and advantage of people. And, okay, cool, maybe it'll be a little more convenient for you, but...
And if there's no driver driving this thing, people, like I always say, they're going to trash these cars.
Right.
I'm just saying because that's probably what like early 20s cab riding Ed Maher would have done.
Right.
Just like, let's destroy this thing.
Yeah. We need a healthy, functioning, working society.
Yeah.
I think, was it, I read an interview with Josh Hawley about this, who was talking about it. People are asking, like, what is Congress going to do about AI and automation? And, you know, there's this talk about, you know, is there going to be universal basic income if it gets to a point where, you know, the AI companies are making so much money, trillions of dollars, where, you know, you can tax them to the point where there can be a monthly stipend given to every man, woman, and child. But people don't want that. People like going to work.
Yeah, there's purpose in life.
Yes, there's purpose in life. Like, no one wants to just sit around and, like, wait for their check and be like, okay, I'll just let the robots do everything now. Yeah. Like, it's just, you're losing your utility and, nah. I'm a hard pass.
I'm with you. And there was a push out of the White House to have a ban on states regulating AI, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've heard about this for the last few months. But then... this new model that came out from Anthropic, essentially they figured out that you could just tell it to identify software flaws. Mm-hmm. And if you did that for, say, a bank, people would just be able to go in and, you know, steal accounts, steal money, whatever. So that's why Anthropic was not able to launch its most recent update.
Right.
The White House brought in...
Mythos or something?
Yeah, Mythos. Yeah. The White House brought in the heads of the Federal Reserve and some of the bigger banks to, like, test this thing out to see, you know, find the flaws and be able to fix them. And then more recently, probably the last week or two, the White House has said that it wants to... take the authority of vetting new releases of AI.
So
they want to give the thumbs up or down, pick winners, losers, which is sort of typical of this administration. But
that means they're scared.
It's a massive walk back and a recognition that, you know, like unchecked AI, unchecked people, we don't let that happen. There are regulations when we're letting people do things. There should be regulations if we're going to sort of open the floodgates for robots to be, you know, driving cars. And again, you know, what you're saying about drivers and workers in general, Phil, it stands on its own in any circumstance. But when you're talking about, like, with vehicles that drive through construction barricades because they don't know, like, if you're driving to work this morning, you know, on a Sunday morning, and a car comes a little bit, you know, like you're driving down and there's a guy on your left and he's coming onto the street and he goes a little over the white line. You notice that and you're like, he might come at me, so I better slow down. AI doesn't,
there are nuances that people
have. And now not every human driver is as smart as you and I, Phil, clearly. But
I'd say the vast majority are not.
But there's a human element that I think we should be really, really cautious to try to allow you know, to get replaced. So
yeah, let's pump the brakes on all this. Let's just have, you know, like, come on.
Yeah. So we've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back after this this quick break with Rocky Cloth from the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Workers' Mic. More show to come, sponsored by Hinge Health. Hinge Health specializes in personalized digital exercise therapy designed for hardworking people, just like you. It's pain relief without waiting rooms and costly medications. Visit hingehealth.com today. Now, back to the show.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, Voya Financial, and United Healthcare.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Workers' Mic on 720 WGN. I'm Phil Davidson, here with Ed Maher. And in the room with us today, we have a very, very special guest. This individual is the senior director for the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council, the place that employs me during the day. And he was based in Kansas City, but spends a lot of time in Chicago now, overseeing our reps and organizers across our five states and the mighty Mid-America Council. So please welcome Rocky Cloth.
Welcome to the show, Rocky. It's good. It's good to see you.
Thank you very much. With an introduction like that, I'm a little bit concerned.
How about it? There was a lot of special words, yeah. Grand. You know,
I like to lay it on thick for my people, Rocky.
That's no joke.
Yes, Ed's heard me when Kevin's on the show. They never let that down when I suck up to Kevin.
That's true.
To no end.
Today, it's just one of the guys, so it's somebody that I'm honored to be here and be on the Workers' Mic. It's a pretty cool opportunity, so thank you.
We're happy to have you, and we know how much Ken is upset that he's not here, because he is one of your biggest fans. And Ken doesn't like many people, myself included, but he really likes Rocky, so.
Well, judge a character, we'll leave that alone.
Okay.
Now, Ken was one of the first ones after the merger that happened in 2021 that reached out and promoting at that time MCL and now the National Coalition of Labor, and just his passion for people. And that was one of the things that he reached out. We got to take care of some folks and built a relationship from there that continues to grow.
Yep. It's the best. We're going to talk a little bit. We want to talk about organizing and just really, what does that mean? I think a lot of our listeners hear organizing, they think just, okay, a guy shows up at a job site and he hands out some cards. He gets people to potentially vote in support and to join a union. But it's much more than that, and that's where we're going to have you provide some insights on. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about your background. People want to know, where you come from? How long have you been in the union? What got you into the union? What was your craft? Let's start from the beginning.
Well, it actually all comes together. So what organizing is, we can get into, but keep this in mind. Started off in construction at the age of 14. I worked for a small family-owned business. It was my parents' business, and did everything that I could to get out of construction. Actually went to school to become a teacher ultimately, and it was funny because as I'm taking care of students, trying to teach them at that particular point, major in biology, minor in math and coaching, started to see that what I was doing was actually just trying to help them have a better way of life, and that's really what we're supposed to be doing anyway. Mm-hmm. So during that process, I was working weekends, evenings, and over breaks.
For the family business.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's how I paid for school.
Yep.
And
we won't talk about the child labor law violations, but that's okay.
Well, it was a family-owned business, so I think they had different criteria.
Yeah. Get a little dispensation for that.
Just a bit. I got it now. It's okay.
You're good.
But in that process, I started actually looking at what the earning potential was for going this college route. I had some student loans, but was able to take care of most of them, living expenses, through what I did on evenings, weekends, and those summer vacations, and realized, wait a minute, what am I doing here? This doesn't make any sense. So the experiences that I had in school actually paid off a little bit later on, but I made the decision, I need to do something that's going to be better for me, better for my family. I didn't have one at that point, but knew at some point it was going to happen. So made the commitment full-time. Construction actually had a floor covering business that was primarily residential, but we started to do more commercial work. And then an opportunity came up where a gentleman came on the job site and did one of those things. Hey, I'm with the union. Do you have a union card? Mm. And I kind of looked at him, and in the back of my mind, these things come to, you know, I stopped. But it was, I didn't come here to play cards. I came here to do a job.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, he didn't take the aggressive approach that so many people have the notion of what a union organizer, business representative would do.
Right.
And he just kind of said, you know, what's going on? You're not union. Talk to me about what this is. Small family business, had health care, had a little bit of a 401k. And he's like, okay, but what else are you getting out of that? And that started a dialogue. He was very persistent in regards that as time went on, he continued the dialogue. And if I hadn't been such a hardhead, probably would have been union about 9 months before we were. What I remember vividly, though, was May 1st of 1995. And that was the day that I finally went into the union hall. And I remember as if it was yesterday. I'm in his office. I have a pen in my paper. I've got a little blue card in front of me, and it was an authorization card for representation. And I remember signing that. That day, my wages went from $10.50 an hour to $17.43. Got a health welfare and a pension that started being paid in, and I realized, okay, something's. If I hadn't been such a hardhead, I could, should have done this, you know, months ahead when I did. But then an interesting thing happened. About 6 months into it, he came up and said, "Hey, we're having some challenges. We need your help. What do you need help with? Because we've got this company that is just taking terrible advantage of their workers. And there's this strategy involved that you go after called batch applications. And I was what was referred to as a covert salt. So I went in just plain clothes, had my tools, ready to go to work. He had applications.
Undercover.
Undercover, completely. Yeah. And the had a phone in my pocket that was transmitting to a group of about 20 other people sitting a block away.
This is like cloak and dagger.
Oh, it was fun.
Yeah.
Ended up the interview process, walked the job, got hired come on Monday. I left, and those folks went in, and this is back in 1995, the fall of 1995, and ended up dealing with some unfair labor practice charges that led to a lot of other things and significant fines. And that brings us to what organizing is, because that set the tone for me. When people talk about what they do for a living, I start off with, I was organized, so now I'm a representative organizer. When we look at organizing, it was there's this notion of NLRB elections, and you get authorization cards, and you go through the election process, and then start the negotiations. I encourage folks to look at organizing a little bit differently. Organizing can show up in many different ways, and for those that are out there that maybe want better for their families, this is certainly something to pay attention to, but also for existing membership. Because the union is part of your life. It is part of who you are, so be a part of it. And when we look at organizing, it's not just a matter of getting a contract or signatory. That's great. That's the be all end
all. That's the goal.
That's the best.
Yep.
But there are other classifications of organizing that come into play. And one of them is maybe we don't get the general contractor organized, but some of our existing signatory partners, we get them on the job. That means our members are getting work.
Yes.
That is a win. That is a matter of organizing. And then you step even more into it. Maybe that isn't the case, but you raise the cost of doing business, but you also provide a benefit to the workers that are working for that. Maybe they're not a dirtbag contractor. They're just somebody that just doesn't know.
Right.
Maybe they're small. They're in their infancy. They're in that pathway of where they're going to go. So if we can help raise the cost of doing business for the contractor, that levels the playing field for the rest of our partners. But for the individuals that are working, they get better pay.
Better pay.
They get better benefits.
Absolutely.
They get something more than what they had if we had not been involved.
Yeah.
And then there are always those that fourth tier of organizing, and this is kind of one of the fun ones. For those absolute dirtbags, the ones that are taking advantage of people, if we can help them change their address.
Yeah.
You can interpret what that may mean however you want to. But that's how I look at things and how we as an organization have really started to approach what it is to be representative of the membership that we have, but also be responsible to the communities that we live, work, and play in. If we level that playing field, if we provide opportunities, if we are actually moving things forward, advancing our communities, we all win.
Absolutely. Yeah, and not just, as you mentioned, not just union workers. This is workers across the board. Like every time there's an increase in a union benefit in the wage scale, that trickles down to especially to the, we'll say, legitimate non-union contractors, like because they're going to start hearing from their employees saying, union guys are making this now, and it helps everyone.
Yeah, we're raising the bar for them.
Exactly.
That's for sure. And I mean, you mentioned one of the things that you said was that when you make a non-union contractor union, it'll raise, you know, their cost of doing business. But I think it's important to point out too that if the difference in wages between a non-union contractor and a union contractor is, say, I don't know, $500,000 on a project, that doesn't mean their bid's going to be $500,000 left on
absolutely
the project.
Absolutely
not. It might be $100,000 less, and they just take an extra $400,000 in profit. But but yeah, I mean, it's a great story, and I think what you said about putting a face on organizing for folks that have never heard it before. Because sometimes you walk into somebody's dining room or meet them at the bar and you're telling them what you have to offer, and it sounds too good to be true. People are like, yeah, you're just going to double my pay? You're just going to do that for me?
No strings attached?
Yeah, because it's the right thing to do. And in a lot of cases that I've seen over the years in organizing, the answer is yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you're skilled. You can do better for your family. It's better to have people working, you know, in this kind of an environment. So yeah, that's the deal. And sometimes it takes a while. So an organizer's got to stay present, kind of be there, always have integrity, be respectful, and just be a good person. I mean, no matter what end of the organizing spectrum you're on, you know, it's not like the old, the sort of the Hollywood cliche of some guy walking around with like a crowbar or something like that. I mean,
yeah, the days of baseball bats may have existed, but we're not going to talk about that.
I don't know.
But
cell phone cameras and everything.
So to your point, that's part of what we have to make sure that we're doing, and that's providing a value. Contractors, look, yeah, those, they want to make money. One of the ways that they make it, quite frankly, and this is one of the other components to it, is, you know, for the company that I worked for, it was a mom and pop shop. Because they provided those benefits, they had to go out and try to find the best value. They had to deal with the brokers. They had to do those things. For us, as a union, we actually make it where they can, you can take care of the benefits. You administer it. I don't have to do anything.
Right.
Oh, that's an absolute benefit for them. Another component that looks at, and we talk about what the benefits are for being union. And specific to construction, it's going to be, you know, the cliches. It's going to be the we're going to provide training and safety and productivity and all the, and contractors, you know, great. What's real? If they can get some of their overhead brought back into line so that they can put that towards their profit, mm-hmm. if they can have access, and that was one of the big things for the company that I worked for, we were working some commercial, but it opened up doorways for us to work on bigger projects.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean? Most businesses are not in place to just be status quo. Most of them want to grow. Mm-hmm. Most of them want to be more profitable. So how can we help accelerate that? And that's what, as the union, we can do today.
Yeah.
So for those non-union companies that may be listening, and I know that it may seem counterintuitive to talk about that on the workers' mic, but really, they can benefit because they don't have to mess with it. And one of the big ones right now has to do with availability of workforce. Trying to get somebody trained, trying to deal with that, learn from a guy who learned from a guy who learned from a guy, and pretty soon it's watered down to where you have a jack of all trades, master right. none, and they're probably not going to be very good at half the trades that they think that they are at. Mm-hmm.
Right.
If they can actually have somebody, look, I turn this over, that's part of the training aspect, that's part of the total package, but I get qualified, competent people, man, that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And you may hear a lot of partnership in the conversations that I have, because it is.
Mm-hmm.
I can be the best floor layer, best carpenter, millwright, cabinet maker, whatever it happens to be. Without a place to work, I'm nothing.
And you want employers to make money. Because
exactly.
if an employer is able to be successful and be profitable and bid bigger projects, then instead of employing 20 carpenters, they're employing 50 carpenters. So,
yep.
you know, this notion of sort of an adversarial relationship between the union and its signatory employers, you know, in any market where it's successful, the people don't look at each other like that because,
no.
you know, you're working together on all these boards, whether it's a training board or the like, pension, like the fund boards. But you're creating this class of skilled workers, you know, that helps the employers be successful. One of the best examples.
A lot of the employers come from the trade,
right?
You know,
absolutely.
A lot of the superintendents, a lot of the owners. I mean, there a lot of them are members.
And you hit the nail on the head. Our contractors' profitability means our members' prosperity,
right?
Yep.
So yeah, it's an absolutely symbiotic relationship. Folks just got to look at it, and unfortunately, those that are on the outside. There are folks that love to draw wedges between us.
Mm-hmm.
When we get rid of the wedge and realize that we're not just in the same boat, we're in the only boat,
yeah.
then we look at things a little bit different.
Yeah.
Totally.
An example I always like to go back to is South Carolina is the lowest wage state in America. And the Federal Highway Administration did a study. The last one that I saw was like 10 years ago. But they compared the cost of building a mile of highway in Illinois versus in South Carolina, and despite the wages. I mean, an equipment operator, for example, makes like $22, $23, no benefits. That's what prevailing wage is in South Carolina. So that's what your workforce is. And you have folks that are making in the mid-90s with total package at that time in Illinois. So clearly it's going to be more expensive to build a road with these people in Illinois than South Carolina, right? Wrong. You have people who are trained, who know what to do. You ever have somebody out to your house to fix something, like your refrigerator breaks down, somebody comes out there, and he just starts scrolling through YouTube trying to figure it out? Like, that's not what you want on a project like a school or a federal
program. It's not going to instill much confidence, is it?
No. So, I mean, having skilled people, and that is, I
feel like you're talking about me when you said that, but yes.
No, I don't even think to look at YouTube. I call some guy, and he comes out and does it, and I'm like, come on, man. But I should have probably just looked at YouTube. But
yeah,
but yeah, I mean, that's what these partners do together is build this skilled workforce. And, you know, one of the things I think that's frequently misunderstood about unions is people think that unions are against non-union workers. And that's not the case, because at its most basic level, a union's function is to organize the unorganized.
Absolutely.
Right? There's a place for everyone. Everyone should have an opportunity to have access to benefits, to make a better living, to have a better life for themselves, for their families.
And shame on our predecessors, set a lot of things in motion for us, and we appreciate it. The health and welfare, the pension, some of those other benefits. One of the notions that is still out there, but we're working to change that on a daily basis. When we look at our folks out there that are unrepresented right now, they're not the enemy. So this notion of the rats and the scabs and all of those things, man, they're just people trying to go out and earn a living, provide for
the family. We're talking about the contractors, not the employees, right?
No, we're talking about the employees. The employees are just trying to do their thing.
The employers are the scabs.
The employers are the problem.
Right.
Because as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you look at that profit margin. The bids aren't – they're not discrepancies.
They're not passing through the savings.
No. No, they're still padding their profit. Yeah. That's when we talk about the folks that need a new address.
Yes.
Well, we've got to take a break, and I feel like we could talk about this stuff for hours, Rocky. But thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, we're going to have Rocky back to talk about some more organizing related content.
Yeah, but if there's anybody out there that's thinking maybe I could look into getting into a union, you know, give us a call. You can call the National Coalition of Labor, 800-433-2099, and if you're looking for a point in the right direction, we can give it to you. But don't be afraid of union organizers, because you just heard of one of the most successful that I know of. And you, as you can tell, he's a nice guy. So, you know, make the call and do something better for your life. But thank you again, Rocky, for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Everybody, go out, make an impact.
Right on.
We appreciate you.
Thanks, Rocky.
Right. We'll be back with more Workers' Mike right after this.
You're listening to the Workers' Mike, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premis Health, Voya Financial, and United Healthcare.
Welcome back to the Workers' Mike right here on 720 WGN. I'm Ed Maher, back with Phil Davidson. We have our villain of the week.
Oof.
It's a new segment that we're starting right now.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, dun. We'll have Ashley, you know, come up with some ominous music. Oh, she's not listening. Never mind, listeners. But
I want our producer to listen.
But in the great state of Virginia, is it a state or is it a commonwealth?
I think
it's a state.
It's a state, but they might go by Commonwealth.
They probably do. It seems like something they would do. They have for, I don't know how many years, but for a long time, they've had a ban on collective bargaining for public employees. So if you're a firefighter, cop, school teacher, public works employee, you can't collectively bargain. And so a bill made it through the legislature to overturn that ban. Great news, right?
You would think so.
Would think so. And it's
especially going for a state that, I mean, obviously the Supreme Court intervened, but had just flipped a bunch of districts blue. Like, it's, you know, it's still a little purple-ish, but it seems like it's a more reliably blue state.
It has. In the last decade, it certainly has become that way. And it's, you know, passed out of the legislature, headed to a Democratic governor who, you know, like in most states, Democratic governors would be the ones that would sign something good for workers as opposed to veto it, which unfortunately is what Virginia Governor Abigail Spamberger has said that she's going to do. She's a Democrat.
Judas Iscariot.
I'm telling you, she is going to veto this bill that would lift the ban on collective bargaining. And I don't necessarily know why. I don't understand
why.
We don't
need to know those details.
It doesn't matter.
No.
I mean, you know, there's so much good that comes from lifting this ban. That nothing really would justify.
How do all the federal employees in Virginia feel about this? Like, they have to be like,
I mean, it's for them, it's probably just more of the same. They see it happening in DC. Now it's happening in Virginia.
Like, yeah.
You know, we've got to show them that there are states in the nation where workers are treated well. You know, if you're listening, Governor Spamberger, and I hope that you are, there's still a chance to make this right, because I understand it hasn't been vetoed yet. So do the right thing. Take care of these workers, and we'll take you off the villain list next week, okay? But with that, we have reached the end of our time. We hope you'll join us again next Sunday right here on 720 WGN with the Workers' Mic.
The preceding episode of the Workers' Mic was powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, Voya Financial, and United Healthcare. For additional information and podcasts of the Workers' Mic, visit WGNRadio.com.